Prepare for a Gopher football knowledge bomb. This is the FBT podcast with hosts MV.
And once again, for the second year in a row, I am pleased to welcome back to the FBT podcast former Gopher captain, Derek Burns. Thanks for coming on the show again, Derek.
Thank you again for having me. It's good to be back. I had a great time last year on the show, and so good to be back with you.
Well, in my quest for football knowledge, it actually understand it on a deep level. It's always good to have an actual resource and not a rube like myself just to kind of bounce ideas off of each other. So I appreciate you coming on and educating me on all things schematic, especially on the offensive line. That's a huge benefit to the cast.
Great. I will be happy to give any perspective I can. And I still remember one or two things. I didn't get hit too many times, so I still have a couple things left rattling around. So I'd be happy to provide some input and maybe some insight.
All right, so let's dive right into it. This year's Gophers, we sit here at 4-1. The loss to Iowa last weekend was obviously a big disappointment, but you know, given the way that everything kind of set up for this season, I think people would have been happy coming out of this particular, going into the bye week 4-1 and giving themselves a chance to get back to bowl eligibility, especially given where that they have been the last couple of years. What are your general observations so far of the team? How do you think they're looking? We could just let it flow as freely as it comes out, Derek.
Sure. Well, I agree with you. I think in 2020 hindsight, you go back and I think most fans would be happy at this point if you were to tell them before the season with the record they have. I think if you're going to look at some positives, the first thing you can look at is I don't think there wasn't a big letdown or a big disappointment when the Gophers were heavily favored. Gopher fans haven't always been able to say that, so that's certainly a first hurdle that I think they crossed. The Iowa game, depending on who you asked and how you looked at it, people may have thought the Gophers were a little favored in that, but all in all, I think anybody would have said that was within, if you want to talk spreads, within a few points. So, so as far as the record, I think that, people can be satisfied with it. I think that, if you look at both sides of the ball, I think, the obvious thing is to, and I guess it's my opinion too, that, the defense, despite having, a letdown at Iowa, especially in the running, run defense, I think the defense overall is a lot better than people thought they would be. So I think that's been a pleasant surprise. Specifically, the pass rush has been excellent. Now they have had the lead in most of the time, I guess, that they've played this year, so that helps. But then also in the secondary, I don't think anybody expected what the things they're able to do in the secondary, especially the pass defense in the secondary. That's been a nice, pleasant surprise. On the other side of the ball on offense, I think that their run blocking is a little better. I think their pass blocking is definitely better. And I think they've upgraded at receiver, at least overall as in that group. So I think both sides of the ball, I think people see an improvement. I think maybe a little bit more on defense than offense.
Yeah, I would not going to sit here and disagree with those opinions at all. From looking at, from your perspective as a former offensive lineman, just how much different or how much does it disrupt your flow of the offense when you have two guys that can get after quarterbacks like D.L. Wilhite and Rashid Hageman can, and how much does that change what you have to do up front and what the offense can achieve, especially in third and long situations?
Well, you just, the last thing you said is the main point. You're with guys like that, you definitely are going into preparing for each team and each individual. So going into the game, you're aware of what they've accomplished. You're aware of what their strengths are. And the first thing you do, of course, is try to stay out of those situations. But you hope that schematically the coaches are going to give you a little bit of help. They're going to try to stay out of things like, long play action plays, five-step drops with double move routes, things like that, to stay out of situations where those guys are on an island. I was a little bit surprised in the Syracuse game that they kept going downfield to some of those long routes, and I kind of felt bad for those tackles because they just, flat out they weren't able to block them. So I was a little bit surprised that they kept pushing the envelope there, but you game plan for them. You try to call plays, try to get some help with the play calling, try to stay out of those situations. And then, when you practice on a one-to-one basis, you try to work on, if a guy's a good pass rusher and he has a couple good moves, you try to that week in practice against those moves, get a good look from the scout team. So, but I guess direct answer to your question is it is disruptive and it is, it's on your mind, what you have to do and the situations that are going to be tougher. So it's always in the back of your head.
Now with you mentioned run blocking along the offensive line was a little bit better. Now last year we sort of had an educational moment from you talking about the three components of run blocking up front and what it takes to get good at all that. And the first thing you need to learn is who to block. And then the second thing you need to go is where to block. And then it becomes your technique. If I can't remember if I'm messing up the order or not.
You almost got it. Go ahead.
No, I don't want to interrupt.
So the three components, and this comes from a couple coaches that I can't take credit for it. It's the way that I was coached, so it comes from them. But if you look at the maturation of an offensive lineman, a kid coming out of high school and also with a new system. So it's not always just throughout a career, but if you change an offensive scheme, the first thing you have to learn is who you're blocking on any given play. So that's your assignment. The second progression is technique or how you're going to block them. And the third part of that is effort. And it is sequential so that if you don't know who to block, your technique or your effort means nothing. You can luck out and guess, the right person or the right area, the right gap to block. But all in all, you can't. It's your effort's going to be fruitless. And similarly, if you know who to block and you start working on your technique, when you get your technique down and you're confident in your technique, you can spend more of your focus on effort, on just executing that with maximum effort. So I think if you're maybe what you're getting at is this year's offensive line, I think you're seeing a progression, a little bit of a progression from last year. And that probably goes for the team overall too, in that under a new system, under a new coaching staff, under new philosophies, you do tend to see from year one to year two, the first thing you see an improvement is usually less missed assignments. That doesn't mean you still won't have an offsides because that's just a mental, a mental breakdown, false start, things like that. But I'm talking post-snap missed assignments by guys. Usually you tend to see a reduction in that in the second half of the first year and then moving on to the second year. So I think without – going play by play and grading guys out, I guess I can't confirm that solidly, but just from from afar, I think that we've seen that. And I think that's been, I guess you could probably attribute some of the offensive line improvement to that growth in year two.
One of the things I've noticed about this offensive line is that even when they've had to make substitutions due to injury, that in certain positions that the linemen have responded quite well when they've been injected into the game and they haven't been too bad, or there hasn't been that much of a drop off between the starter and the second teamer. I think the prime example of this was when they moved Zach Epping over to center, which I think is at least for this season is probably the better move, one that should be made permanent. And then Caleb Bach assumed the role of a starting right guard. I think the drop off between Epping's level of understanding who to block and then his technique, and Bach's understanding of technique and where and who to block is minimal, even though that is not so great that you're losing a lot of production on that side. Whereas I think we're struggling a little bit with Tommy Olsen going down with an injury and then having to move John Christensen over there, who was formerly at center. So, I mean, I'm curious to hear what you have to think about that, and maybe get into a little bit more specific stuff. Because, like, I've started to notice that we were running almost exclusively power on about 80% of our runs. Almost 80% of our runs are with power. So maybe if you've noticed that, your comment on that as well.
Sure. So the first part, that's, I guess, the small drop-off or the lack of a big drop-off, I think, you know, it can be credited to the coaching staff. I think that, you've heard them say that we rep a lot of guys. We don't heavily rep first stringers and then bring in second stringers as an afterthought. So I can't verify that myself. I haven't been at watch practices play for play, but if you believe that, then I think that's where you might see some of that consistency, you know, moving guys around and getting guys reps so that they're comfortable with that. Also, if you're playing the same people, if you're mixing up the lines so that you're not always playing with the same guys, that also helps. So you get a feel for it, you know who you're playing with and things like that. Regarding the what was the second part of the question?
I noticed that we're running a lot more power now, especially with Tommy out. And then moving Zach over to center.
Yeah, I actually that's been a little bit of a curiosity for me. Now I'm a little bit, admittedly, I'm a little biased because we were a really really heavy zone running team. We ran I don't know what percentage it was, but very high percentage of zone, inside zone and outside zone. So I'm a little bit biased, but I really. A little bit baffled by that. I've seen that what you're saying. I've seen them. The power just seems to be their go-to, kind of their bread and butter. They're leading with power, and they've sort of mixed in inside zone. I guess if I were to give my opinion, I would like to see them run more inside zone and use power as a sort of a counter to that. The way that the defense reads each play is totally opposite because. With inside zone, first steps are always to the play side. So inside zone to the right, every single lineman on the snap of the ball, their first step is to the right. They're always blocking one gap over. Where power, the front side of the line is front side of the play side, they're all blocking down. So it's definitely more of a counteraction. So I would like to see them, I guess, use that a little bit more as a counterbalance. I think it would be more effective if the defenses saw more zone and then saw power. I think they would be maybe a step behind. I think you'd have a little advantage there. But then again, when you coach an offensive line and you see them run these plays dozens of times, I think you do get a feel for what they're able to accomplish given their strengths and weaknesses. Zone blocking takes a little bit more athleticism and a little more speed. Power is definitely more of a, as the name would say, it's definitely more of a power down blocks or man-to-man blocks. It's a different technique. It's more strength. It's a little more push off the line of scrimmage. So perhaps the coaches have seen it enough where they feel like, they just have better, they're going to have better success going power. But I, again, being a little bit biased, I think power is a little bit easier to defend if you're expecting it than inside zone.
You know, my observation or my theory behind all of this is that when Marquise went down, well, at the beginning of the year, we were a mix between all three of our sort of blocks. So we would run inside zone and then we would counter that with power. And then I I think one time in the UNLV game, we ran pin and pull to the field, and instead of running towards, you know, the direction of the pulling guard and center, Marquise ran up the middle and basically cost himself a touchdown. But we don't need to get into that. So my theory about this is when Marquise went down and you lost the ability to the offensive line really lost the ability to gain three, four, 5 yards on almost every single play because Marquise can just gain yards that way because he's 250 pounds. That they sort of limited what they were going to do in the running game so that they can get what they felt was the most consistent yards. And like you're saying, zone blocking takes longer. It's definitely technique based. So if you don't have a quarterback who can read, if you mix in a little bit of zone read, or if you just have him, you know, if you just fake a sweep and then have him run right into one of those gaps, then you're going to gain some positive yardage on it. But when you don't have that now, you're really limited about what you're going to be able to do up front blocking. So that's just kind of my theory with it. And then also, obviously, injuries play a huge factor in this as well. When you're starting two, you know, essentially three walk-ons in the two deeps now, and one of those guys is a redshirt freshman, and then another is only a sophomore, and Zach Epping is also only a sophomore too. It really limits what you're able to do. So that's my observation.
Yeah, I guess a part of that that I would definitely agree with is when you have a quarterback able to run, then you're able to utilize another guy in the box. When you're handing off, essentially, unless the quarterback's giving a really good post handoff pass fake or something, that guy's a dead player. I mean, he's no longer effective. Now zone read's a little different. You know, if he's carrying out a good fake, but you're adding another guy. It is another weapon. That's one of the big benefits of having a running quarterback is you're able to have another guy in the box that's useful and effective on the play, and that being the running back if the quarterback's running it. So I do agree with that, and I think everything you mentioned plays into it. I think the injuries become a little bit of a limiting factor. I think that not having the quarterback be able to run is certainly contributes as well. I thought that I don't want to keep going back to the Iowa game. I know you want to put that behind you, but I thought that Iowa beat Minnesota in the box on both sides of the ball. I thought that their seven or eight on defense beat our seven or eight on offense. That was just the way it was. So I would have liked to have seen them try to attack the edges a little bit more, maybe try to pin and pull, a bubble screen, something like that. I didn't feel like Iowa had great team speed, but it's tough to do some of those things when you get down quickly and you get down substantially. It's tough to go to some of those things. If it had been a little bit closer, maybe they would have.
You know, I'm glad you kind of mentioned to talk about the attacking the edges a little bit and getting down. So one of the things I've kind of surmised about this team is that being that it's still kind of a young team, and I know people sort of argue this back and forth, but I'm sorry, when you're starting a backup true sophomore quarterback and then their backups are true freshmen and you're starting all kinds of underclassmen along both lines, you're a young football team. I don't care how much experience you have at linebacker or in the secondary or at some of the receiver some of the skill positions. You're not an experienced football team, and they're definitely not. They're neither an experienced football team nor a old, mature football team. So getting back to this, when you get down, it's tough to kind of claw your way back into a game, especially when you miss so many opportunities earlier in the game. I think one of the issues that I had with the Iowa game was the plays were there to be made. I mean, it was clear going into the game that Lime Grover's game plan was to really attack Iowa secondary downfield because he didn't think that they would be able to cover our receivers. And I think he was mostly right. I mean, there were guys wide open and kind of streaking down the field all the time. And I think Max either underthrew in the case of the first Barker interception, and I think the Devin Crawford Tufts interception as well. And then he overthrew Crawford Tufts and Frickty and just plain missed wide open guys that he didn't see on a number of occasions. So this all goes back to the theme of that this team really doesn't have a huge margin for error. And it sounds trite, but I actually find it to be true because they don't have the physical ability up front to just dominate the line of scrimmage and that they could just run for 150, 200 yards with a running back, nor can they just afford to miss wide open plays like this and not be able to move down the field. I mean, we saw how many different times against Iowa where we would get backed up because of a big punt from Iowa's punter and that we wouldn't be able to go anywhere. You get a three and out because you miss the pass on first down that really would set everything up. And then all of a sudden you're giving Iowa back really good field position again. You know, and conversely, on defense, maybe you want to talk a little about your perspective on this. This is the first game I felt like the team didn't execute well at all. That they were missing tackles. They didn't match the intensity that Iowa was coming with, but they also didn't play well at all. They did not play up to the level which they played against Syracuse or even against Western Michigan or any of the other teams that they had played, and they really kind of beat themselves. So they gambled a little bit more than they did in an effect to try and stop Iowa's running game, but they also didn't play well at all. And our C game is definitely not going to beat Iowa's A game when they bring it. So that's kind of the result that happens.
Yeah, I agree. Going back to what you said about offense, because I know there has been a little bit of back and forth, and people have talked about where the offense fell short and game plan. I 100% agree with your comment that the plays were there to be made. The progression that you have as an offensive coordinator with in a game plan like they had is this. I think that for as long as Jerry Kill and his staff are here, their first go-to is going to be running the ball. And this is the case with at least three quarters of teams probably in college football. But so you start out and you want to run the ball. I think that when they saw Iowa bring an extra guy in the box and play the run tight, and even when they weren't playing the inside runs tight and just, you know, I think winning the game in the box overall, your second progression as an offensive coordinator is to look for something on the edge, bubble screen, maybe look for some three-step passes. So that's your second progression. Beyond that, if you're playing some man press and some tight coverage, which Iowa was, your third progression is to push the ball downfield against man coverage, and which is exactly what they did. The Gophers just needed to come up with a big play, one or two, in the passing game in the first half, and that would have alleviated the pressure. A team is not going to continue to play man press and play with their back to the quarterback if you hit them with two 40-yard, 40-plus-yard passes. They got to back off. So I felt like they made the progression. They saw what Iowa was trying to do. They went through, by the book, normal progression. They pushed the ball downfield. But it was sort of the case, I felt like on the offensive side of the passing game, that it was if Shortell had a guy, at times he didn't hit him, and then at other times when he hit him, they dropped the ball, or it was a good play by the defender. It was just sort of disjointed. So I do think that they really could use a wide receiver to sort of a big possession wide receiver to go up and get. I don't think they've found that yet to go up and get those that man press fade pass where you throw either back shoulder or try to get a step on him. I'm not trying to knock the wide receiver play. I think overall it's been good, but I think they've missed that. They've tried that with Barker. It just doesn't seem like he's able to do that thus far. So
I want that particular page of the playbook actually thrown out. if I'm being serious, they've tried that play at least twice and it's been intercepted both times. And I like Barker as a receiver, but I don't like Barker as a receiver that's going to try and go win jump balls or kind of out-muscle a defensive back for a pass. I think he's better technique and route running, which is obviously going to be a cliche of all cliche takes, given that he's a walk-on. But going into the season, I felt like Andre McDonald was probably going to be that guy, but obviously given that his injuries and health situation, that it's how much practice time he's missed, that he's not – they haven't been able to do that. And I don't understand why they haven't maybe tried to do that with Fricke. He is a taller, bigger receiver. Maybe just by sheer mass he'd be able to out-muscle the defensive backs. But you're right. I think that some of the fits that they have, so to speak, the personnel packages that they're trying to do are not necessarily working for what they're trying to accomplish. And I know that Kittle has mentioned a bunch of different times that he wanted receivers and playmakers who can go up and actually, you know, win and fight for a pass. And you're right, he just doesn't have that right now. And unfortunately, that makes your level of execution needed on every single play have to be that much better. So you can't miss a block. You can't miss or drop a pass. You can't not see a wide open John Rabe on a post on a third down. So, I mean, those are just sort of the things that compound when you have a developing offense like this in the second year of a program, and the level of talent that you're facing is not going to allow you to get away with making mistakes like that.
Yeah, and I think I don't want to sound like an excuse machine, but to your point about being young, I think it's important to point out that I think when the coaching staff is talking about that, it's what you said. They're young if you just look at the sheer numbers, they are young at they're light at senior, and the numbers are more, you know, towards the younger guys. But also, when you're in the second year of any program, it doesn't matter to a certain degree how many seniors you have. They're in the second year of this system, and I'm not trying to say it was, you know, there are some things that carry over. It's not night and day. It's not reinventing the wheel different maybe from what they were running before. But there is a maturity factor and an experience factor with the new system. So I think there's some of that. And you're right, there's a narrow margin for error on when you have guys and you have opportunities, you have to hit it. And you know what? To Iowa's credit, if you're looking at a game plan and – you've got to give them credit because they probably went into the game saying, number one, we're not going to let them run the ball on us. We're going to try not to do that. Number two, we feel like maybe we don't have great team speed, so we're going to take away stuff in the flat and on the edge. So where does that leave you? Well, we're going to take some gambles and hope that if they're going to beat us, they're going to beat us on down the field passes. And that's what they forced the Gophers to do, and the Gophers weren't able to. Maybe they felt Iowa felt like that gave them the best chance, and credit to them because that's the game plan worked for them.
So you mentioned again about the second year, going to the second year of program, and that doesn't matter it doesn't matter really how old you are. When you're in the second year of a program, you're going to be inexperienced and still going to be learning, so to speak, and you're not going to be like an Iowa where their system has really been in place for over a decade, and they're kind of just swapping out coordinators. And there were some struggles of it early on, but they're still kind of going with what they know. Your experience in the very beginning of the Glenn Mason era, so you were around from the very beginning. Have you noticed anything that outwardly from this team that sort of resembles what went on with your experience as a Gopher, that there's a sort of change and sort of momentum building towards a year like 1999 or an upward trajectory of the program? And if so, what are those type of things that you can notice from this current team?
Sure. So as I kind of alluded to earlier, I think I have seen the progression that you would normally see from a team coming in, learning a new system the first year. Sometimes that's actually more difficult on some of the upperclassmen because they played longer in the system. So teams under a new system, new coaching staff, I think have a tendency to play younger guys because that can sort of be a factor. And I think perhaps that's factored in a little bit with this team as well. But I think the most specific example I can give that I've seen with this team is the way that the defense is executed with this scheme compared to what was there before. Now, this isn't, I guess this isn't analogous to what happened under when I was there with Glenn Mason, because it was a little different defensive philosophy. But so what I think the most specific example I guess that I could give is the play of the defensive line. It seems that the philosophy of this defense, this defensive scheme, is to keep in the secondary, keep everything in front of you, be a little bit more conservative back there, but on the defensive line, just let guys go and rush the passer. It seems like the philosophy is that your best defense against five-step drop and long passes is your pass rush. And I noticed that the very first game last year that this coaching staff coached, I think that's when they took one of the offensive guys and put him in at D end to try to get a rush on the passer, because they were saying, we just need to, you know, they were kind of getting picked apart passing the ball, and they were like, we just need to get a rush. You know, normally you would say, well, what's going on in the secondary? Why are these guys running around wide open? I think that the philosophy is that you keep things in front of you. You're going to give up a 5 or 10 yard, you know, comeback, stop routes, things like that. But you're hoping that your pass rush is going to get there in time to help defend some of that. So I think one of the things, maybe the chief thing that you've seen from year one to year two, is I don't think those guys on the defensive line were ready for that at all last year. I think they were still in the mode of, you know, I'm a read and react. I'm watching keys on blocking. I'm watching for a down block. I'm watching a guard cross my face. If he crosses my face, I'm going to flatten out. I'm playing the run. I'm looking for inside zone. And oh, by the way, after those six keys are up, then I'm going to rush the passer, you know, and I'm going to stay in a lane, and I'm going to rush. I'm going to try to get my hands up, whatever. Whereas I think this new scheme is you have your run check for one count, and then you're rushing the passer, just, you know, all out. So I think that that's been a something that's had a big improvement this year, and I think it's because of that experience of being in the system for a second year.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about that. They refer to it as the John Teerlink style, where it's almost like your run key is on the way to rushing the passer. So everything is moving forward and attacking a gap versus, like you said, having a bunch of different run checks and then saying, okay, well, now I can go after it. They definitely like to unleash these guys. One of the things that was brought up by Mark, I believe his name is Mark Henry, he was on a podcast with Yahoo's Dan Wetzel last week, talking about the Big Ten and what's wrong with the Big Ten and why is it down and, you know, what can be done to fix it. He actually had a very interesting comment where he said Minnesota is a philosophy and a team to watch moving forward because they do things differently than the entire rest of the Big Ten. And his specific comment was, I don't think that Minnesota or Kill is going to see it as an insult to their manhood to maybe give up 140 yards individual rushing if they win the game and stop everything else. And I'm kind of curious as to what you sort of think about that type of comment, if you think it's true or not, and if you think that that can actually hold up in a conference where you have teams like Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan. I won't say Nebraska, because Nebraska's rushing style is a lot different than Iowa or Wisconsin's. But do you think that can actually work going forward?
Well, I think that 10, 15 years ago, no chance. I think that the way the Big Ten was set up then, with you had a lot more run first, run heavy teams, and I don't think this defense is set up. I mean, you can defend that run, but I don't think it's built for that. But moving forward, I think that part of the reason they employ this philosophy is I think they feel like they can get faster guys that are a little undersized and be able to live with that. So I think he's probably right in feeling that, you know, if you're going to rush for 140 or 150 and we win the game, we don't care. I think that what you run the risk of is that this defense lends itself to being better with a lead than behind. when your team has a lead, I should say, and behind, if you play a team like Iowa or like Wisconsin or someone that wants to run the ball and they get up a couple scores, I don't know that this defense is built for that. On the other hand, if you are playing a team, you know, at a tie or you're up 3 points or up 7 points, I think it's when you're forcing the other team to take some risks, pass the ball a little bit more, I think it's made for that. So, of course, you know, it remains to be, as Sid Hartman would say, we'll see. One of his better predictions on everything, but we'll see how it works. But I think it has a chance. I think you have to be realistic in the near term about the type of athlete and the type of player you're going to be able to recruit here. And I think that it's a good system for the time being to work with in the Big Ten, especially given the a little bit more tendency to pass and you know, spread, things like that.
Well, I think that the reason why this sort of philosophy works is the defensive philosophy can work is twofold, in that if you rotate guys like Clay's likes to do, he call it with his hockey line shift, you're not taking as much abuse from every single one of these lighter guys just getting manhandled all game. So if you're playing seven or eight linebackers and you're playing eight or nine defensive linemen throughout the course of a game, they stay fresher. They're not going to get beat up as much, and they're not going to get beat up as much over a course of an entire year. But on the opposite side of that, there's a reason why Lime Grover's play calling philosophy is conservative. And I think it's exclusively because of the way that they play defense. I think you're 100% right when you say that this defense is better playing with a lead or better playing with a tie. Because when they force the issue, they can get teams to start passing on earlier downs, that they make things just very tough, as we've seen against both Western Michigan and Syracuse. When we had the lead, we simply battered their quarterbacks. Because if there's no threat to run on an early down, they don't really have to defend against it. And they can just pin their ears back and do even more exotic things from the secondary. And then if you can bring pressure with four, you can bring pressure with four. But, you know, getting back to Lime Grower's philosophy, I think people are going to have to accept that he's not going to be the super wide open offense. It's not going to be the type of high-flying action that people want. And the reason why Kill's offense was so awesome in year three at Northern Illinois is because Chandler Harnish was in year three. Chad Spann was a senior. Their offensive line was veteran. They had veteran skill position players. They were 3 years into it. This is fundamentally an execution-based, ball control, conservative offense. That's the identity. And I really do believe that this is by design to sort of counterbalance the defensive philosophy, and not sort of Lime Grover just being conservative for being conservative's sake.
I think that I agree with that, and I think that that's will continue to frustrate people. I know that as fans and as armchair fans, people just like to see more of a wide open offense. They want to see more bullets, you know, on offense, more, you know, stuff more downfield. I do think that this is what they're going to live with for now, especially early on too. I think you're going to be more apt to be conservative for that reason. People underestimate how much stress is put on a defense by an offense that isn't able to control the ball and spend a little bit more time on the field. I think it was the Gophers' first or second year, perhaps under Tim Brewster, when they had, I think it was like they called it the spread coast offense, and they were scoring like crazy, but they were scoring in like, you know, a minute, 2 minutes, and the defense that year was just, I mean, they just got slaughtered because you're putting a lot of stress on your defense by having them out on the field. And I know people like to argue about how important time of possession is. I don't think you can sum it up in just that one stat, but it's about, you know, controlling the ball, and it is partly time of possession. It's partly how long and how close you keep the game, and if you're able to get a lead, you know, sticking with that lead. So I think that they are going to be conservative. I will say that even my patience can be tested on stuff like that. I think in the Western Michigan game, it was before Gray got injured, I thought they took that a little too far. I think when you're playing a team like Western Michigan, you can take some more risks. I mean, they had 12 guys in the box against the run, and we continued to try to run the ball. I think that became a little bit ridiculous. I think you need to open it up a little bit against a team like that. But certainly, as the opponents get better, I think you're gonna see that, like it or not, that conservativeness.
Yeah, and that's not going to make a whole lot of people happy, and they're probably going to feel that if you play conservative for the whole rest of the way, that it's a recipe to get beat. But considering how the talent level, the talent and execution level of the team right now, and the maturation of this program is not to the level where they can just simply overwhelm teams with talent or execution, they're going to play to keep things close more often than not. And who knows? I mean, we haven't really seen any big special teams plays or any defensive touchdowns to date. But it could be one. There could be a game or two later on this year where we keep things close, we keep it close, we kind of grind things out, and then all of a sudden we get the one key critical play on special teams or defense where we end up getting a score or setting ourselves up for a score on a short field that people are going to say, oh, okay, now I understand it, but I still don't like it.
Yeah, I do. I think that I do think they believe that special teams for sure, as you mentioned, and then also I think they feel like this defense is set up to, all else being equal, if you have a game of playing against this defense and having to pass a little more than you'd like, I think they feel like this type of defense is going to be able to force a fumble or an interception. And if you can keep that from happening on offense, that's also maybe going to be enough of an edge to give you a win.
So I'm going to name a team, a program that I think both on offense, defense, and special teams most closely resembles what this coaching staff wants to do, especially with recruiting and development. And you tell me if I'm completely off base and nuts.
Okay.
Virginia Tech.
The only thing I would say, I don't get to watch them as probably, I probably for sure haven't watched them as much as you have. I do know just about the program. The only thing I would say there is they definitely feel like special teams is going to be that they're going to play things equal, and that special teams is going to be their, that they feel like that's the way, that's been their hallmark for a long time. No, I don't think that's off base. I don't know enough, to be honest, schematically with the comparison, but yeah, I would say that building something where you're playing it close and hoping that another facet of the game gives you, gives you enough to win it. I think that, maybe that's what they're after. Well, expand on that. What were you thinking? What are you thinking for talent wise, or just the scheme, or everything?
Yeah, it starts on their defense, that they used to run like an 8-man. You know, they would run an 8-man front, and they would have that rover, spinner, defender, whatever you want to call them. But then when they started to face more spread offenses, and they were neutralized, that they found that spinner, that 8-man, 9-man front, so to speak, wasn't as good against the run when the college football was changing. Then they switched over primarily to a quarters, and a boundary corner type system. And that's almost exactly what Clay is doing right now, that he's running, doing a lot of stuff where he's isolating his corners a lot, in playing a lot of quarters and press and getting a lot of pressure. And I think from a general defensive philosophy that Virginia Tech and Bud Foster have always sought speed at all costs over size, and they've had really good defensive line and secondary play, number one. And I think that's sort of the hallmark of what Clay's has been able to do, that at each step of the way, that the kill wants, he wants one lockdown corner, and he wants one really good pass rusher. And I know every coach in America wants one of those, but I get why they want to do it, because if you can get one good corner, put him on the boundary, and you've effectively shut down one quarter of the field, and then you can get really good safeties too that can make checks and make a lot of plays in the secondary like we're seeing now. and just one guy, let alone two that we have this year, you can change a lot of things on defense, and it can help help scheme things in your favor and make put the pressure on the opposing offense. And just in general, I think that they value this. This coaching staff values special teams a lot. I don't know if they value it as much as Frank Beamer at Virginia Tech does, but they definitely have put a lot of emphasis on blocking punts and returning kicks and things like that. And then just on general on offense, I think that Virginia Tech has always been a run first team. They've always been strong up front, and they get really smart quarterback play. And I think that's sort of the other hallmark of the Kill Lime Grover offenses, that they get really good decisions out of their quarterbacks and know how to manage that. You can't say that about a lot of programs around the country.
I interestingly, I thought that last year, and I think you and I may have disagreed on this, so maybe we could bring up something we disagree on. I thought that last year the Gophers didn't match up well against quicker athletic teams, Michigan, Purdue, teams like that. I just didn't think we had the athleticism, the tackling wasn't there, sort of teams that made you tackle in space. Even Northwestern, I thought, was just a little bit of a mismatch. And it seems like this year, I'm judging from the five games, it's almost like it seems like the opposite. I thought Purdue was a really good, or excuse me, Syracuse was a really good test for that, to see do we match up well against those teams that are going to make you cover space. And we just, I mean, resounding yes, of course. And then on the opposite, the teams that are a little slower, a little stronger, a little more nose to nose, I think we might have more trouble with those type of teams. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think passing teams, unfortunately, there are not as many passing teams, you know, pure passing teams left on the schedule as there were at the beginning of the season. Mm-hmm. And with Northwestern being probably the only team left on the docket, that you could actually consider more of a spread, not power, physical up front type of offense or defense for that matter. So, but yeah, I agree with it. I think that it all depends on the sort of matchups that the opposing team is going to bring out. So like you said, Iowa's offensive line was probably better than they were playing at the beginning of the year. And I think part of that could be due to that they were just having a lot of issues with the transition from Ken O'Keefe to Craig Davis and the new offensive philosophy there. So when they went back to their bread and butter, which is just running outside zone, a little bit of inside to mix it up, that they really kind of refound their identity, and they're kind of like the new old Iowa team, so to speak. But but there are other teams on the schedule, like namely Wisconsin. I don't really know what kind of read I can get on that team's offense specifically. I know that they're having schizophrenic quarterback play, to say the least. Yep. So that could play into the Gophers' favor, depending upon who starts. If Stav is the guy, then I think they're going to get a little bit more. Wisconsin's going to get a little bit more consistency. But O'Brien was just a mess through the first four games. He was just terrible. And along their line, this isn't the same Wisconsin offensive line like they've had in the last 3 or 4 years. Partly due to the fact that they've just lost so much talent up front. So I don't know if Wisconsin tries to run with ball up the middle like they do, like that they have for the past five games. I actually think that we can handle that. Where I think we run into issues is where teams run something different at us, like an outside zone, like Iowa was running, because we don't face that in practice, and we haven't faced that all season. So we had no idea what to expect execution-wise. So teams that like to spread it, that like to run to the edges and can be mobile with their linemen, like in Iowa, I think Nebraska is a team that likes to do it. They like to spread out their linemen and create wide open holes for Martinez or Abdullah to run through. They could give us some issues. I think Michigan could still give us a lot of trouble, just because Denard has a lot of speed, and he's really difficult to handle in the open field. But against a team like Wisconsin, I just don't know. It's so hard to get a read on that team. And and knowing what our strengths are through five games, it's difficult for me to see. It's just, again, it's a tough read. I don't know.
Yeah, Wisconsin's offensive line is the difference this year. I mean, that in my opinion, that's the difference this year. And I think I said the other day before I die, maybe someone will realize that Wisconsin's success has been as a result of their offensive line and not a series of good running backs. Ron Dayne was a step ahead of the rest of the guys. I think he was a pretty good college, a very good college running back. The rest of the guys, in my opinion, are good, but got way too much credit. They've had really good offensive line play, and that's just not the case so far this year. So that, to me, has been the big difference. So you're right. It does become hypothetical when you haven't seen enough. But to your point, if the game is any indication of practice, then this team probably hasn't seen a lot of zone. They've probably seen a lot of power instead of zone. So that could factor in.
Yeah, I don't know. This is going to be kind of a curious development for the whole rest of the year. I'm sort of interested to see where this team goes from here. They don't have a whole lot of margin for error. It's still, I think, doable that they win the two games they'll need to make a bowl. But they're going to have to play at the level of which they played against Syracuse. And they're going to need to get healthy again and get Marquise back. I don't care what anybody says about that. They need Marquise. Mm-hmm. So if they get all those factors back, it's possible that they can, if they play at the consistent level, which is difficult to do for a young team, and they're definitely going to play better at home for that reason, that they could, if everything goes right, get a couple of breaks along the way and then come out of the Big Ten play with two wins, get those desperate, they really need those 15 extra practices for a bowl, you know, get some positive momentum, maybe, you know, nab a better recruit or two, you know, on signing day, and then just continue to develop along the way. I think this season, more so than any other, it's paramount that they get to that 6-win plateau no matter what it takes. As much as I don't want to risk playing Philip Nelson and taking off his red shirt, if that's what it's going to take to actually win a game, if Shortell is out and Gray can't play against Northwestern, you have to do it. I think the future of the program for what 15 extra bowl games and what kind of momentum that would bring is so much more important to the development. And maybe you can attest to that, because I know you guys were one game away from that level back in 1998. So I can only imagine what the team would have been like in 1999 had they had that 15 extra practices.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of value to that. And also, I think another important thing with picking up a couple more wins through the rest of the schedule is then you're not ending on such a slide. If your schedule ends up being such heavy wins up front, you're ending on more of a disappointment. You're ending on a big slide, and that certainly doesn't help in all facets, recruiting, you know, the team itself, guys coming back. So I tend to be a guy that I kind of scoff at the, I think we put too much into the, you know, morale talks and high notes and low notes. I mean, I think guys give effort and regardless, most of them. And I think that a lot of that stuff maybe is overblown, but I do think there's something to be said about some picking up some wins later in the season, getting some momentum, getting some extra practices, learning what it's like to go to a bowl game, learning what it's like to play another bowl eligible team. So, can I ask you a question that I'm hoping I can find something that I'm pretty sure we can disagree on this. So I do have to ask you this question because I feel like I'm definitely alone in this regard. Do you think that this is the game that I guess everybody's sort of playing in their heads? It makes for good conversation, but Gray comes back, whether that's 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it is, when he's back and healthy, is it a no-brainer that he's back at quarterback and then Shortell's off the bench, or do you play two quarterbacks, or do you move Marquise, or where do you fall on that? Because I'm pretty sure I'm not going to fall on the same side.
You know, if this was last year, I made this point pretty public that if this was last year, I was absolutely 100% on the side of Marquise. It's just so difficult to win with a true freshman quarterback in the Big Ten that it's, if you can avoid it at all costs and you don't have to go that route, that you go with, you ride it out with your experienced quarterback, even though he was making the conversion from wide receiver, and that you just let him play out through his struggles. This year, I'm more agnostic on it. I don't really care as long as the team gets those two extra wins. So whatever the coaches feel like is going to give the team the best chance to win and give the team the best matchup is what I want them to do. I will say, though, that like a Northwestern-style two-quarterback system that they're running down there with Coulter and Semien is so unique, and the scenarios that have played out the last 2 years for them to even reach that point is not really realistic for this team, for Minnesota to replicate this particular season. I think that if you do make the decision to go with Shortell, you have to find a way to put the most physically talented guy on the field a lot of times. On the field, you can't just have Marquise sitting on the bench. But at the same time, I just don't know how they're going to be able to do that, considering how it's not really the staff's philosophy, other than maybe on a couple trick plays, you know, and running stuff. I know that they did some stuff with Jordan Lynch when Chandler Harnish would take a breath or two for like a snap. But yeah, I'm curious to hear what your response to this is going to be.
Yeah, I hope it lives up to the question. I feel like they should. If and when Marquise is back, which that's another conversation, a high ankle sprain, we can talk about that. I had a high ankle sprain myself, and so I think people are writing off how easy it is to re-injure that. But anyway, when Marquise is back and healthy, I don't think they should put him back at quarterback myself. A couple of reasons. I think that where the offensive line is right now, For example, the last game, I don't think he's able to, the way that Iowa won the battle within the box, I don't think he makes a huge difference. I don't think he can make, for sure, on some passes and scrambling, absolutely. But in the running game, I don't think he's going to make something out of nothing. I also think that I've seen some things from Shortell. He's actually had, I feel like, two or three passes per game that he's completed that I don't think Marquise Gray could complete. I don't, you know, or at least that we haven't seen him complete. So I think there's a little bit of higher ceiling there in the passing game. And then some of the things we talked about earlier, you know, why did they struggle in the passing game? Yes, it was part Shortell, but there were some other things too that certainly didn't help him out. So I think at this point in the program, I think you give him more experience, you play him more, and now I don't think this is going to happen, but this is just my opinion. I think you do mix in Marquise Gray at wide receiver. He's a little bigger this year, so it'd be interesting to see if his effectiveness at that position would be affected. But as a possession receiver, I think everybody, maybe people forget that he was an All Big Ten or certainly near the top possession receiver. And we mentioned earlier, probably the best guy on the team right now to run against a fade pattern against man coverage, whether that's in the middle of the field, you're going downfield, or when you're in the red zone or inside the 15-yard line to throw it up in the quarter of the end zone and have him go up and get it. So I think you can add some things that wide receiver. Now, that being said, I probably doubt he's had a lot of practice, if any, at wide receiver in camp or this year at all. Maybe he has, but so there would be certainly be some challenges, but I do feel like that's the way they should go, and I'm probably in the minority on that.
You're definitely the minority on this podcast. that's for sure.
Good, we disagreed.
I think half the time to do that would have been last year. That would have been the call that would have been made, but because they've developed this basically this entire run game and run scheme behind that, and they put so much effort into developing him that way and and developing him a quarterback and really molding the offense about around what he can do versus what Max can do, that I don't think there's enough time. There's not enough time in practice when you need to spending that time also prepping for the opposing defense to be able to effectively do it. So, I mean, it's a nice call in theory, but like you said, he's coming off a high ankle sprain, and who knows when he's going to come back from that. I mean, they're already suggesting that he's not going to play against Northwestern. I mean, we could be looking at a scenario where he might not even be back until the Purdue game. I mean, he could be out for 6 weeks. I think that's sort of the roughly the time frame that if you go on WebMD or sports injury database or whatever people do these days, that's how long it takes. I mean, you could probably shed some more light about a high ankle sprain, but
it was interesting. They when they talked about he seemed to have a pretty good recovery early on, but that sort of stalled out. A high ankle sprain is a difficult injury to come back. It really for full recovery, you are talking weeks and weeks. Now, when are you able to play? That's a different question. But there is a pretty good risk of re-injuring it, because you're talking about injuring the weight-bearing tendons and ligaments in your ankle, as opposed to the outside of your ankle, which is your non-weight-bearing. So it really restricts your lateral movement, and every step is affected. It's an injury that's less severe for an interior lineman, someone who doesn't have to do a lot of lateral running and even just all flat out sprinting. So it's definitely going to affect him more. And then, like I said, coming back from it, the chance to re-injure, I think, is pretty high, because those ligaments aren't and tendons aren't fully healed. It's not like, again, not like rolling your ankle outwards, where as soon as you take down the swelling, it's basically it's all but healed. It takes a lot longer with a high ankle sprain. So you're right, with this conversation or the debate may never we may never see an end to it, or it may solve itself, maybe is a better way of putting it, because it may be quite some time until he's able to. And then, of course, how the team does in the next few games, may determine that on its own. But the last thing I would say, the last point, though, that would be something interesting that I'll throw in is regarding building the team around in the offense around kind of what he does and his strengths. It's interesting to note that I don't think you would know this more than me. You probably studied these guys more than I have, but I don't think any of the quarterbacks that they've recruited or signed, any of the two freshmen and some of the guys they've recruited, are Marquise Gray style quarterbacks. Is that accurate or no?
Yeah, they're more Chandler Harnish ish than they are Marquise Gray ish.
So they can run, though. They could conceivably be a dual threat, because I guess where I was going is maybe this offense, maybe we aren't going to see as much of the of the Marquise Gray style offense that they're trying to run in the future, just given who they've recruited. But sorry, go ahead. What do you think that those guys are able to run?
They'll be able to run. I think this staff is pretty committed to the zone read and to having a mobile quarterback. The first thing that Gil mentioned when he was hired was that he likes to have a mobile quarterback. because it, you know, obviously the mobile quarterback can, you know, get out of a bad situation and make plays happen with his feet and keep plays and drives alive when otherwise a pocket passer couldn't. So I don't necessarily know that they're going to pick that they're going to go after such an unpolished product like Marquise was as a quarterback. I think definitely if they had brought him in as a freshman, he would be much further along than he is now. So if, they, if his staff had gotten their hands on him, they wouldn't have. I don't believe they would have mismanaged him so much like the Brewster regime did. But yeah, I think moving forward, they are going to have a mixture of quarterback runs and some quarterbacks that can run. But they also want quarterbacks that make really good decisions. So that's if anything can be said about the quarterback mix that we have right now, I think that the odd man out of this conversation really is Max, and I mean this in the most polite way possible, but he's sort of a gunslinger, and he really trusts his arm, and he can certainly make throws into really tight windows and throws that nobody else on the roster can make. And he definitely has an NFL type windows. He can make those throws, but he can also trust his arm too much in a sort of Farvian type way where it'll get him into trouble. Like he'll underthrow or he'll try and press something too much and he'll end up making some bad decisions. And I think they have to try and temper that if he's going to become a starter moving forward, that they really need to teach him about not making critical bad mistakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed with his mobility in the last game. I know that straight ahead, he has decent speed, and you know, for his own read, where you're keeping the ball and you're looking for the hole and you're running straight ahead, I think he's capable of that. But it seemed like he was a little bit more immobile, and maybe it was just that he was just giving more time to reading the routes and the receivers. But he does. I will agree with you. He does have all confidence, and he's very patient. He gives a lot of time for his receivers, but the decision making is definitely something that comes with maturity. And I think he feels like, especially when he sees man coverage, that he feels like he can place the ball where it needs to be, and that the receiver is going to, going to go up and get it, or that they're going to be on the same page. And you have to look at sometimes the risk reward of that, and look at some other options too. So I think the coaches know that, and they're probably coaching them up on it. So I would agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to end this podcast here. So once again, thanks again for coming on the podcast here. It's always great to have you on and to drop some real knowledge for the Rube Nation out there.
I really appreciate it, and it's good to, I'm just a fan now, so I enjoy it like everybody else, and glad that if I can throw in some insight and some experience and contribute it anyway. So thanks again for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
All right, take care, Derek.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Mm-hmm.